In chapter 29, we'll be covering central nervous system pathology. We're going to begin talking about infections of the CNS. We'll start off with meningitis. The board expects you to be able to tell the difference between a bacterial and a viral meningitis. So let's start off talking about acute aseptic, or also known as viral, meningitis. By definition, the virus, usually an enterovirus, will inflame the leptomeninges. Remember how your body responds to viruses. It tends to respond with lymphocytic inflammation. The good news is that, yes, you can get a fever. You'll have signs of meningeal irritation. Patients can develop depressed consciousness, but usually there is a low morbidity and mortality. Let's compare that, though, with bacterial meningitis, much more severe condition. It tends to be an acute, purulent infection, where the leptomeninges are covered with a purulent exudate composed of bacteria as well as neutrophils. For each age group, you should know the specific type of bacteria that causes meningitis. For instance, for neonates, you should know about E. coli and group B strep coming from the vaginal canal. For infants and children, it's H. flu. Of course, the United States, the incidence has gone down for this age group because now we're giving the HIV vaccine. In adolescents and young adults, you want to think of Neisseria meningitis. And finally, in the elderly, think of strep pneumonia. On examination of the brain, the meninges tend to be thickened. They tend to be covered with a purulent exudate. The brain itself tends to be edematous. These patients tend to come in and present with headache, fever, nuchal rigidity. They can get clouding of their sensory, their sensorium. Ultimately, they wind up with coma and death. It can be a very severe infection. Now, I want you to refer to table 29-1 and look at the CSF parameters for the different forms of meningitis. A board favorite question is to give you the CSF findings and expect that you understand the difference between a bacterial and a viral infection. So let's look at a purulent CSF pattern or a bacterial infection. Notice that the white blood cell count will be elevated and it's composed mostly of neutrophils. The glucose level tends to be decreased because it's been used up by neutrophils and bacteria. The protein level and the pressure tend to be markedly elevated. Now let's contrast that with a viral meningitis. In the CSF, the white count will be elevated, but this time it's mostly lymphocytes. The glucose level tends to be normal, and the proteins and pressure tend to be just slightly elevated. Okay, let's move on and talk about encephalitis, actually inflammation of the brain. It can be due to viruses, it can be due to fungal organisms as well. Let's start talking about the viral encephalitis. Remember, your body's going to respond with lymphocytic inflammation, so on microscopic, you'll see perivascular cuffing with lymphocytes. You can also see microglial nodules and neuronal loss in these various viral diseases. Clinical manifestations are very variable. You can have anywhere from headache to mental status change to coma. Now, on the exam, there's only a few that they've asked about. They like to ask about herpes simplex type 1. Especially, they like to ask you which part of the brain undergoes necrosis. And the answer is the temporal lobes. The next one they'll ask about is in a child who's gone out in the woods and gets bitten by a rabid animal. It's rabies. And in the brain, you'll see Negri bodies. These are inclusions within neurons. They're most commonly found in the hippocampal and Purkinje neurons. The next one I want you to know about is PML, progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. You should know that it's caused by the JC virus. And in the United States, it's most common in immunosuppressed patients, especially AIDS patients. Under the histopathology, I want you to notice that there is demyelination. Why? Because the JC virus infects oligodendrocytes. Remember, oligodendroglia are responsible for myelinating the CNS. So it's not a surprise that in this disease, you're going to have areas of demyelination. Let's move on to the fungal meningoencephalopathies. The two big organisms I want you to remember are Aspergillus and Mucor. Both of them have a tropism for blood vessels, so they tend to be very, very hemorrhagic. And on the exam, for Mucor, they love to give you a diabetic patient who develops a sinusitis. And the Mucor actually will not only invade the sinuses, but invades and bores its way up and into the brain. That's how it gets there. For Aspergillus, it's usually somebody who's immunocompromised, so somebody who's on immunosuppression for transplant, or somebody who has AIDS. The next organism I want to talk about is toxoplasmosis. Again, this is common in AIDS patients. It tends to form cerebral abscesses with central necrosis and surrounding chronic inflammation. On CT scan, you'll see characteristic ring-enhancing lesions. Let's talk about cerebral abscesses. Cerebral abscesses usually occur because of bacteria, which get into the brain by hematogenous means. Usually the person has had an endocarditis, and one of the infected vegetations has broken off and implants itself at the gray-white matter junction. It's a classic location. Again, on CT, you'll see ring-enhancing lesions. And these patients are usually pretty sick. They have increased intracranial pressure and can present with headache, vomiting, and papilledema. Let's move on to prion disease, also known as spongiform encephalopathies. The big one in this category is Jakob Creutzfeldt's disease. Now, this is an unprecedented disorder. This disease is caused by a protein, which in some cases is inherited, some cases it's a spontaneous mutation, and some cases it's actually infectious. You can actually catch this disease from someone else. That's unprecedented. We've never before had it in a disease caused by an infectious protein. It's absolutely fascinating. Now, what's interesting about this protein, it's called prion protein, and everyone has it. You have it, I have it. It's a normal protein. We abbreviate it as PRP. It's present normally in neurons. Now, what's interesting about this protein is normally it has an alpha helix configuration. Now, either due to mutations or due to association with abnormal proteins, the protein will change its conformation. It will now form beta pleated sheets. That is the abnormal form. And we call that PRPSC. Okay, and that causes all the damage. Now, I want you to remember that it's hereditary, so you can inherit it. You can also catch it. You can catch it from corneal transplant. You can catch it from getting electrodes in neurosurgery when it's used on one patient. When you transmit that and use it on another patient, you can transmit the disease. The last way you can transmit this is with growth hormone. We used to take cadavers, and the way we make growth hormone is we go from cadaver to cadaver, taking the pituitary from each one, grinding it up, and concentrating the growth hormone. Well, guess what? You can transmit this protein as well. Now, here's the problem with this protein. Once you develop this beta-pleated sheet, it has a tendency, this protein, to attach to the normal proteins and change the conformation of these proteins so that they also form beta-pleated sheets, and this protein begins to accumulate. And what are the characteristic findings? Well, we call it a spongiform disease because that's what the brain looks like. It begins to look like a sponge. In the gray matter, you'll see a fine vacuolization of the neuropil. The other characteristic finding is these proteins, they're abnormal. They begin to be deposited in tissues as amyloid. We call these Kuru plaques. Now, what are the clinical manifestations of these spongiform encephalopathies? Well, for Jakob Creutzfeldt, most cases are sporadic. Only about 15% are familial. Usually occurs in older individuals, either middle age or older. And they tend to have a spectrum of clinical findings. At one end of the spectrum, they have dementia. At the other end of the spectrum, they have motor difficulties, motor incoordination, ataxia, and so forth. Now, the problem with these diseases is once you start to see manifestations, it usually will rapidly kill you, usually within a year. Very, very severe disease. Okay, let's move to a different category now. Let's talk about cerebral vascular disease. Will this be on the exam? You bet it will. because it's the third most common killer in the United States. The risk factors for cardiovascular disease are the same ones as for atherosclerosis. And for cerebral vascular disease, I want you to remember two clinical syndromes. One is TIAs, the other is stroke. TIA stands for a transient ischemic attack. Basically, this is reversible. What happens is you start to have neurologic signs and symptoms, which get better within 24 hours. A stroke is you have a neurologic deficit, which remains stable over time. That's the big difference. Now, also for a stroke, you should remember the causes. The two major causes are infarction and hemorrhage within the brain. Infarction is a lot more common. It's about 85%, so we'll talk about that first. Okay, for infarction, again, 85% of all strokes are caused by it. The two big etiologies are a thrombotic occlusion of a coronary vessel or an embolic occlusion. Okay, so it's thrombosis versus embolism. Thrombosis, the big risk factor is atherosclerosis. The plaque gets bigger, it ruptures, you develop a thrombosis on top. Now, the thrombosis tends to block the entire cerebral artery. As a consequence, the tissue, when it infarcts downstream, it dies, and it tends to be a pale infarct. No blood can get through. Let's contrast that with an embolic occlusion. The embolism usually comes from the heart chambers. It goes up and it lodges, it gets stuck within the vasculature, within the artery. Now, it blocks off enough of the blood flow so that the tissue downstream dies. But notice and remember, a thrombus has a shape. So if you notice here, there's an area where blood can get around this thrombus. And the blood gets around it, it goes into the dead tissue, and you'll develop a hemorrhagic infarction. Good. Okay. Let's move on and talk about table 29-2. Talk about the gross and microscopic changes within an infarction. Initially, you don't see any changes grossly. In fact, it's not until about 24 to 48 hours where you start to see a loss of the junction between the gray and white matter. Finally, about 2 to 10 days, the tissue actually becomes dead. It starts to become friable. It starts to become edematous. It will finally liquefy in 2 to 3 weeks. And then over time, this fluid will be reabsorbed. So if you look at the same area a year later, all you're left with is a cyst surrounded by a glial scar. For the microscopic, the changes are similar. Again, you don't see any minimal changes early. 24 to 48 hours, neutrophils start to come in. 2 to 10 days, histiocytes come in and start to eat away the tissue. 2 to 3 weeks, you'll see the liquefactive necrosis. And then finally, you're left with a cyst with astrogliosis surrounding it. Let's now move to hemorrhage, which is the other major cause of stroke. Causes about 15% of all cases. And for hemorrhage, there are four major forms. The board likes these, so pay close attention. The first is called an epidural hemorrhage. This is always associated with trauma because these patients usually have a skull fracture and they rupture the middle meningeal artery. You develop a hemorrhage, it's above the dura. Now, the problem with this is it often will lead to herniation of the brain, which can be very severe. Clinically, these patients tend to have what's called a lucid interval. Basically, it's called the talk and die syndrome. And I think of it like this. Say you're playing hockey, and somebody comes up and just takes the stick and just whacks you in the head. You get hit in the head, you're like, oh, I'm okay. You might take a couple of steps, then you collapse. That's how this hemorrhage presents. So trauma, a couple of lucid seconds, and then you collapse. The next type of hemorrhage I want to talk about is a subdural hemorrhage. Again, it's usually traumatic. It's due to the tearing of the bridging veins. The hemorrhage will be beneath the dura. And how does this present? It can present with headache. Patients can be drowsy. They can have some focal neurologic signs and symptoms. And the problem with it is, one, it can present delayed. That's why whenever you have a kid who falls down and hits his head, you always tell the mom at night, when you're watching the kid, wake him up from time to time. Make sure he hasn't gone unconscious. Okay? So it can present delayed. The other problem with it is it tends to be recurrent. Once you get one, you're at higher risk for developing more. Next type of hemorrhage in your handout is called a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Just remember, the most common cause is a rupture of a perianeurism. Usually ruptures during times of strenuous activity. And the clinical presentation is classic. They call them thunderclap headaches. It's like the worst headache of your life. The last type of hemorrhage is called intracranial or intraparenchymal hemorrhage. This is frequently fatal. The big risk factor for this is hypertension. So therefore, it's more common in African Americans because they have more cases of hypertension. It tends to involve the basal ganglia and the white matter most commonly. Notice the symptoms. They can have severe headache. They commonly will have increased intracranial pressure. They'll have nausea and vomiting. Unfortunately, a lot of times they'll lose consciousness and go to coma and die. Now, I just want to say a few more words about the perianeurism. Remember, we talked about it's one of the most common causes of a subarachnoid hemorrhage. They tend to occur in the anterior portion of the circle of Willis, usually at branch points. They are a congenital focal weakness, and they are associated with hereditary disorders. For instance, they're associated with autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome type 4, and Marfan syndrome. And remember, they tend to rupture when you're having exertion or increases in blood pressure. Okay, let's move and talk about demyelinating diseases. There's really only one that is 5-star for the boards. It's called multiple sclerosis. Remember that this is a chronic relapsing and remitting disorder. It's probably autoimmune in nature. And it basically presents with recurring episodes of demyelination, not only in the spinal cord, but also of some of the nerves, especially the optic nerve, and the brain as well. As a result, you develop progressive neurologic deficits. Let's look at the epidemiology for multiple sclerosis. The prevalence is very high in northern latitudes. It's more common in women because we think it's autoimmune. And also, it's more common in the third and fourth decades of life. Now, there is some genetic associations. There is a familial propensity. There's also association with HLA DR type 2. Let's look at the pathology. The acute lesions, you want to look for MS plaques. These are areas of demyelination. And this is a board favorite photograph. Most students will miss this one because they look, there's nothing obvious. You got to look really closely. So let me show you a photograph so that you'll get this question. Here's a photograph of a cross-section of the brain. Notice this darker, grayer area, this is the gray matter. The whiter area is the white matter. At the edge of this photograph, you'll see a space here. This is the ventricular cavity. Now, if you looked at this brain on the exam, you might panic. There's no big blood. I don't see any big mass. Before you panic, I always want you to look in this one specific region. Where do MS plaques occur? They tend to occur in the white matter around the ventricles. So if I take a look next to the ventricle, everything should be white. If I notice in this area, it looks gray. That is what an MS plaque looks like. In fact, it's the same gray color as the gray matter, because it's undergone demyelination. Let's look over here. Ah, there's a bunch more. Here's another one. Here's another one. Here's another one. Here's another one. Once you see one, you start to see lots of them. Okay? So please remember, before you panic on the brain, look for the MS plaques. Okay. Let's talk about the clinical course. In most cases, this is a relapsing and remitting disorder, so they tend to have bouts. And what are the classic signs and symptoms? Well, the optic nerve can be involved, so they can have blurring of vision. They can develop double vision or loss of vision in one eye. They can develop sensory or weakness in the extremities. And finally, they can actually develop a hemiparesis of one half of the body. How do we treat these patients? Well, we think it's autoimmune, so the acute attack, we give high-dose steroids. We can also use interferon in some cases. Let's move on to talk about the degenerative and demyelinating disorders. There are three big ones in this category. Board loves to ask about Parkinson's, Huntington's, and Alzheimer's. Let's start off with Parkinson's disease. By definition, you've lost the dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra. That results in tremors, rigidity, and akinesia. Let's look at the epidemiology. It's fairly common. About 2% of the population will develop this. It tends to affect older individuals in their fifth through eighth decades of life. Okay, let's look at the pathology. And this is characteristic. They lose the pigmentation in the substantia nigra. Under histology, the neurons that should be pigmented are lost in the substantia nigra. The other thing you'll see under the microscope are Lewy bodies. These are pink, eosinophilic inclusions, which contain alpha-synuclein. Let's talk about the clinical manifestations. On the exam, they tend to have slowing of all their movements. They develop a tremor. We call it a pill-rolling tremor. They have a mask-like emotionless face. And finally, they develop muscular rigidity. We call that cogwheel rigidity. And they develop dementia and depression. How do you treat this disorder? Well, you use drugs, especially levodopa. Let's talk now about Huntington's disease. This is an autosomal dominant disorder characterized with degeneration of the GABAergic neurons of the caudate nucleus. Let's look at the epidemiology. It's more common in Northwestern European descendants. Let's look at the pathology. You gotta know the genetics. Huntington's gene is located on chromosome 4. It produces a protein called Huntington. The mutation occurs within this protein, and the mutation tends to be a triplet repeat mutation, where you have repeats of this triplet again and again. You can have thousands of them. Last thing I want you to remember about Huntington's disease is it's associated with genomic imprinting. Remember, that's when the disease will look different depending on whether you inherit it from your mom's chromosomes or your dad's chromosomes. One other thing that they've asked about is it's associated with what's called anticipation, meaning that each generation, as you pass this trait on, the disease gets worse and worse. It presents earlier and it's more severe. That's anticipation. For the clinical manifestations on the exam, it's going to be characteristic. These are going to be young patients, 20s, 30s, 40s. They're going to come in with dementia, and they're going to come in with Huntington's chorea, these purposeless movements. Okay. The other thing that these patients often will do is they'll try to commit suicide very commonly. Okay, let's look at table 29.3 for the dementing disorders. One of the biggest ones is Alzheimer's. So let's make sure we cover Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's accounts for about 60% of all cases of dementia in the United States. Notice that some of the risk factors, aging, head trauma, aluminum is associated with it. One of the protective factors is higher education. So right now, you and I, we are preventing Alzheimer's disease. Okay, let's look at some of the genetic factors. About 5 to 10% of Alzheimer's are hereditary. Let's look at table 29-3, talk about some of the genetics. Okay, one of the big genetic mutations occurs in presenilin genes. There's presenilin 1 and presenilin 2. Both of them will result in early onset Alzheimer's disease. Another protein I want you to know about is amyloid precursor protein. This gene is located on chromosome 21. Okay? And if you remember, in the middle of a senile plaque, you'll see amyloid. It's basically amyloid precursor protein, which is being laid down. Why this is also important for the exam is if you remember Down syndrome, they have an extra dose of chromosome 21. So if they live old enough to their 40s, they almost all will develop Alzheimer's disease. Last gene I want you to know about is the apoprotein E, or ApoE gene, especially the allele E4. This is also increased your risk for Alzheimer's disease. Now let's look at the pathology. In Alzheimer's, you will have an accumulation of proteins. One of the proteins that accumulates is amyloid. We already talked about, remember, amyloid precursor protein on chromosome 21. It accumulates and it will form your senile plaque. The other thing protein that accumulates is tau protein. It's a microtubule-associated protein. And usually you see it within neurofibrillary tangles. Now, under the microscope, there's four lesions you should know about. The first one are the senile plaques. I will illustrate that with a microscopic photograph. Let's take a look at this photograph. This is an example of a senile plaque. Here it is. I'll outline it for you. Notice that there's some pink material in the center. The pink material is amyloid. So there's always an amyloid core. Now, what are all these elongated black structures? These are all dendritic and neuritic processes which make up the senile plaque. So those are the two major components. Okay, that's a senile plaque. What else could you see microscopically? You could see neurofibrillary tangles. Again, those are accumulations of tau proteins within neurons. What else can you see? You can see granulovacular degeneration, basically granules and vacuoles within neurons. And the last changes within neurons you can see is heteronobodies. Now, in Alzheimer's disease, clinically, they have a problem with learning and they have a problem with memory. So which part of the brain is probably going to be affected? Well, it's going to be the hippocampus and also the temporal lobes. If you looked at an Alzheimer's patient's brain grossly, you would notice that it is very atrophied. You would see thinning of the gyri, widening of the sulci, especially in the hippocampal and temporal regions. Let's look at the clinical manifestations. Most cases of Alzheimer's, the ones that are non-hereditary, tend to affect patients in their older age group, in the 7th and 8th decades of life. They present with progressive memory impairment, especially to recent events. They have alterations in mood and behavior. They can develop aphasia as well. And ultimately, they become mute and bedridden. Very, very sad disease. Unfortunately, there is no effective treatment for this disorder. Okay, that completes the dementing diseases. Okay, now let's move to CNS tumors. Talk about the epidemiology first. I want you to remember that 50% of tumors are metastatic. The other 50% are primary. Of the primary tumors, the most common are glioblastoma multiforme and meningiomas. How do these tumors present? They present with headache, seizures, mental changes, focal neurologic signs and symptoms, and increased intracranial pressure. Now, for brain tumors, the concept of benign versus malignant has to be changed. Because remember, malignant brain tumors do not metastasize. They kill you first. And what makes it malignant is because it invades adjacent critical structures. So it kills you before it would ever metastasize. Okay, let's look at table 29-4. Talk about the differences between primary and metastatic tumors. Primary tumors tend to be single. They tend to be poorly circumscribed, and their location is going to vary depending on what specific type of tumor is it. For the metastatic tumors, they tend to be multiple. They tend to be well circumscribed, and they tend to occur at a very unique location. They occur at the gray-white matter junction. Okay, let's go through the primary brain tumors one at a time. First one we'll start with are astrocytomas. These are tumors of astrocytes, so they tend to have a fibrillary background. They will also stain with one of the intermediate filaments. They stain with glial fibrillary acidic protein, GFAP. Another characteristic of astrocytomas is they tend to have a very ill-defined or diffuse growth pattern. Now, when you talk about astrocytomas, you got to talk about grading. We've got what's called the Dumas-Duport grading system, where basically you put them from 1 to number 4. The one I want you to remember is grade 4. A grade 4 astrocytoma is called a glioblastoma multiforme. It's the most common tumor in adults. It's also the most common on the exam. So you got to know about a GBM. Under the microscope, you'll see the following. You'll see marked atypia of the cells. You'll see lots of mitoses. You'll see necrosis, and you'll see vascular endothelial proliferation and hyperplasia. One last thing that's very characteristic is the areas of necrosis, the tumor cells tend to line up around it in like a picket fence manner. We call that pseudopalisading. So on the exam, if they give you a brain tumor and they have necrosis with pseudopalisading, you got the diagnosis. It's GBM. Okay, where do GBMs occur? They tend to occur in the white matter. The other interesting thing about this tumor is the way it spreads. It loves to go across the corpus callosum and involve the other side of the hemisphere. In fact, when it does that, it tends to take on a butterfly shape. So we call these butterfly gliomas. Just a descriptive pattern, description of the pattern of infiltration. Okay, finally, what's the prognosis? GBM is a very, very bad tumor. It's got an incredibly poor prognosis. Problem is, it's very hard to surgically excise. And that's really the treatment of choice, complete surgical excision. Okay, let's move on to the next tumor. It's the oligodendroglioma. It's a tumor of oligodendrocytes. It tends to occur in adults in their middle ages. It involves the white matter, and on the exam, it always presents as having seizures. When they do the biopsy, the way you'll make the diagnosis is that the cells tend to have a perinuclear halo, which makes the tumor cells look like a fried egg. The other thing that's characteristic is they have a chicken wire vascular pattern. Basically, all the thin capillaries, they cross one another. So it looks like, you ever see the chicken fences that hold the chickens in the chicken coop? It looks like that appearance. Okay, the good news about oligodendrogliomas is they have a very long survival. Average survival is about 5 to 10 years. The next tumor we should talk about is the meningioma. This tumor arises from meningothelial cells, from the arachnoid. This is a tumor of adulthood, usually adult females. The characteristic finding on gross examination is these tumors tend to be attached to the dura. They're dural-based tumors. Under the microscope, the tumor cells tend to have indistinct borders. It's hard to tell where one tumor cell stops and the next one starts. So basically, it looks like the tumor cells are forming a syncytia. The other thing is the tumor cells tend to have whorling patterns or fascicles. And finally, you'll see these dystrophic calcifications, which have a laminated appearance. We call them somoma bodies. In general, meningiomas have a very good prognosis, and surgical excision is usually curative. The next tumor in your handout is called primitive neuroectodermal tumors, also known as PNETs. Now, these are highly undifferentiated tumors. They're pretty aggressive. The one that you should remember for the CNS is medulloblastoma. It tends to occur in children, usually occurs in the midline, and it tends to involve the cerebellum, most common location. Under the microscope, the tumor tends to look like small, round, blue cells. The tumor cells can also form these rosettes. They call them pseudo-rosettes. These tumors tend to be highly aggressive, but they do respond to radiation. Now, how does a medulloblastoma spread? You should know that it does spread by seeding the CSF. In other words, a tumor cell breaks off, floats in the CSF, and implants itself somewhere else. Finally, resection and radiation for these tumors has a 5-year survival of about 75%. The last two tumors I want to bring to your attention are schwannomas and craniopharyngiomas. For the schwannomas, the thing I want you to remember about this is neurofibromatosis type 2. Remember, those patients will have bilateral tumors of the 8th cranial nerve. They're bilateral acoustic neuromas, also known as schwannomas. For craniopharyngiomas, The board loves to ask about the where do they come from. They tend to arise from remnants of Rathke's pouch. The other thing that they'll ask about is the gross description. These tumors tend to be cystic tumors. And actually, when you open the cyst, they tend to be filled with this thick black fluid. Kind of looks like motor oil. The last thing is that histologically, under the microscope, they tend to resemble the tooth. And they have an adenomatous pattern, growth pattern. That completes chapter 29, the central nervous system.